been doing in there. And I suddenly realized I'd left the champagne aria on the gramophone, and I wondered if he'd notice later.
I took the umbrella off her, he said. She got into your room when you were ill, and I was nervous of what she might do.
I thought I'd seen her, I said, but then I thought I'd seen a lot of people.
She got in here, and she took food too, he said. I should have told you, but I was ashamed. And she didn't take anything else, anything valuable.
But the records, I said, smashed in the garden. That must have been your mother.
No, that was me, I'm afraid. I'd put them aside for Suki. And, well, anyway, one night she got into Frank's house. My mother, I mean. I don't know how or why, but she did. And Frank was out, and Suki got a fright and came running here. It was about 10 o'clock, and I was coming home from the pictures, and I met her in the street. We had a row. She was angry, having been so frightened, and I was angry because she said things about my mother. They weren't meant to be cruel, but I was hurt all the same. And then Suki went off home, back to Frank, and I went up to my room and smashed the records. And, not knowing what to do, put them at the end of the garden. And you discovered the bits before I could move them.
Please let us be friends again, I said, quoting Suki's letter aloud, without thinking.
What?
I shook my head. Did she tell Frank about your mother?
She wanted to tell him, but I asked her not to, he said. I didn't want that brute to know. He'd have used it against me.
Douglas carefully finished his last mouthful, and I took his plate to the sink, staring at the pale underside of a moth, its body lit up and exposed against the glass.
What did Suki say? Ma asked. That made you so angry?
She told me I should send my mother away somewhere, to an institution. But I couldn't do that. It was bad enough the old house being gone, and then my sister's things were buried beneath the rubble of the new house. I couldn't lock Mother away too. All she ever wanted was to go home, to touch the things my sister had touched.
Chapter 18.
I want to go home, I say, but there's no one around and the words dissolve in the empty air, muffled by high, thick shrubs and deep turf and precisely clipped trees.
I've got a tiny sort of shovel in my hand,
and I'd use it to make some noise if I could find anything else hard to bash it against.
I don't know where I am.
I don't know how I got here.
There's a smell of cut grass, but there are no flowers.
Please, I say again, I want to go home.
Beyond the hedge someone is walking, bobbing along. I try the tiny shovel on the trunk of a tree, but it only makes a faint thud, so it's no surprise whoever it is doesn't hear me. I wonder if I'm supposed to dig my way out. I seem to have been given the tool for it, but how do you start a tunnel?
I never paid much attention to all those old films. Never thought I'd have to escape from Colditz myself.
I walk across the lawn towards the street and stop by the hedge, plucking off leaves and holding them in my hands. I fold them up and rip them into bits and scatter them on the grass.
But I'm not going to eat them, no matter what anyone says.
A woman crosses the road. She waves, and I duck down behind the hedge, landing sorely on my knees.
Hello, Mum, she says, leaning over, making the hard strands of glossy leaves bow and bristle. What are you doing down there?
She has short blonde curls, this woman, and freckles in her wrinkles. I get up slowly from the grass, pushing my arms into the hedge for support. My trousers are covered in little bits of leaf, and my hands are stained green.
I've come to take you home, she says. Was it okay?
I ignore her and peer at the houses opposite. I don't recognize any of them. They are too new, too clean for my street. There are a lot of builders in shiny jackets on one side, and a great mound of that stuff, sharp, gritty stuff. It makes me think of the beach and Suki and bleeding fingernails. It makes me think of before the war, when I was 7 or 8 and Suki buried me up to my neck. I tried to dig myself out, but I couldn't, and the grains got pushed into my fingernails, and my wrists were sore, and I was so panicked that I worked my way further down into the stuff, and it covered my mouth, and I was choking. "I know you're very angry with me," the woman says, "but I'll make it up to you." "Very angry," I say. "I was so angry I went home and smashed all her records and buried them in the garden." I can feel the anger now and see the records, but somehow the two things don't fit together.
"I thought we could visit Elizabeth."
"Elizabeth?" I say. "She's missing." The words are correct, familiar, but I can't think what they mean.
"No, she's not, though, is she?"
The hedge makes another bow at the words, and the shimmer of it frightens me. I don't trust this woman, and I can't see her below chest height because this plant has grown too tall. I study her face, but I can't remember what people look like when they're lying.
"You've been feeding her," I say,
and I pull a leaf off the plant. "No, I haven't. She was in hospital, Mum. A stroke unit, remember? Remember we talked about it?" "Again, and again, and again." She says the last bit through her teeth.
"And we went to visit her, didn't we? When you sprained your thumb. Anyway, she's still at the rehabilitation unit because she's not swallowing properly. But we can visit her again now, if you like. Do you want to visit her?"
I don't know what this woman's talking about, and I can't see her arms or legs. I begin to wonder if she has any.
"What do you call this?" I say, holding up the tiny shovel.
"It's a trowel."
"Aha! I thought you'd know that," I say. "I've caught you out there, haven't I?"
"Mum, do you understand? Peter said you can go and see Elizabeth. But remember last time, it might be a shock. Elizabeth doesn't look the way you remember her, does she? She's still the same person, though, and she does want to see you."
The woman smooths a hand over her hair, and I can see one arm now. I keep saying the word trowel in my head. I have a feeling it will be important later.
"We can go today if you want. I can call Peter. Would you like that?"
"I'm so sorry I had to leave you here, Mum," she says, starting to walk along the hedge. "I want to make it up to you." I can see all of her once she's standing behind the garden gate. It's made of thin iron bars, and she can't hide behind it. I can see her navy blue Wellingtons and grubby jeans. I can't think why she's here. I can't think of her name. She's like one of those people you mistake for someone else. One of those people you think is the person you want it to be. I always want it to be my daughter now, but it never seems to be her. I used to want it to be Suki, and I saw her everywhere, in the precise movement of a shop girl as she pressed powder to her nose, or the dancing step of an impatient housewife in a grocer's queue. I carried on seeing her in other people long after I was married and settled and a mother. She was still in the smudge of a face seen from a car. There's a car now, and driving, and a bird flying up from the road, and someone sits on a bench by a shop, and a dog is tied to a lamppost. "Helen?" I can't think what else I want to say.
I pull the seatbelt away from my body and let it snap back. There's something important. Trowel. That wasn't the thing. Not even close. Images blur together, words too. The bandstand in the park, the ugly green and yellow house. Oh, Mum, cheer up. I'm taking you to see Elizabeth. She looks at me quickly, and then back through the windscreen. I thought you'd be pleased. Light bounces off a mass of cars, and I feel dizzy. And then somehow we're in a long white corridor, and a man is squeaking by. His shoes seem to make a tune from long ago, a song about lilacs. And, as if they are part of the same production, two people carry bunches of flowers past us. "Those for me," I say. And they laugh, as if I've made a joke. We walk along corridors. Corridors! Each one the same. And I think we must be going round in circles. "Are we lost?" I say. But it seems we aren't. We've arrived. It's a room full of people in bed. "All these people should be made to get up," I say. "Can't be good for them just lying there." "Don't be silly," Helen says. "And keep your voice down. They're poorly." The room is very bright, with white sheets and big lights and railings everywhere, like a sort of indoor park. My mind won't focus. "Mum," Helen says. I can only think of one word, and it isn't right. I know it isn't right. "Bandstand," I say. "Bandstand." Helen walks towards a bed, and there, that tiny little thing with the crumpled face. That's Elizabeth. Her eyes are closed, and she looks scrunched up and withered. Has she always looked like that? I stand by the curtain for a few minutes, staring, and then I move closer and pull the curtains round us, closing us in, hiding us. A man is standing over the bed. He has a very raw-looking throat. "She had a rough night," he says. "But she'll wake up in a bit. Just be quiet." I sit down quietly, very quietly. I don't want to disturb her. Elizabeth is here. I smile at her, but she doesn't smile back. She's tucked tight into her huge bed. "Yes, have a rest," I whisper. "In a minute we'll have a cup of tea. I might even have some chocolate in my bag. Or perhaps I could make some cheese on toast." "You'll need something, Elizabeth. That son of yours keeps you on starvation rations." "Starvation?" the man says. "Rations?" And then you can tell me which bird is which just by looking at their shadows. And I can dig up the broken records from the garden, and we can listen to the champagne aria.
"It was digging in the garden that got her in this state," the man says. "Do you hear me?"
He leans over, his raw throat stretched taut. Elizabeth is asleep, half sitting up. She lists to one side, and her mouth does too. And it makes me feel as though we're rocking, as if we're on a ship. I hold on to the side of the bed to keep myself steady.
"You were digging in the garden. Do you remember?"
I imagine my eye is a tiny point on the side of my head, and I turn as far from him as I can. "I don't know," I say. "Where was I?"
"In my mother's garden."
"No. I don't know where that is."
"In Elizabeth's garden," Helen says. "Peter, can I have a word outside?"
"No," I say. "I wouldn't dig there. You never know what's buried under the ground by those new houses. Douglas said there could be anything."
"Is that another accusation?"
"No," Helen says.
"It's not."
She asks Peter again if they can talk outside, and he whips the curtain open and shut. making a sound like a saw. I swish it about myself, trying to create the same effect, until I find the material tugged from my grasp. The room seems small now that it's just me, and the walls don't look quite right. They move with the breeze, and I have a feeling of being on a boat. A tissue sticks up from its box like a sail, and I pull it out before slowly tearing it to bits, listening to the voices outside. A woman sometimes. A man, mostly.
It was the shock of the fall that caused the stroke, he says, and I've been asking myself what the bloody hell she thought she was looking for. I know for a fact she found something and didn't tell my mother what it was. If it's anything valuable, we want it back. It's ours by right.
A carton of juice sits next to the tissues, and a little white plastic comb next to that. I drop the bits of tissue on the floor and start to brush Elizabeth's hair with the comb. Gently, gently. Her hair is all white now, no streaks of grey left, and the comb looks dirty in comparison. It makes me angry. This isn't good enough for Elizabeth. She should have something better. I go through my handbag again and find I have a tortoiseshell comb, but it's curved and carved, and for keeping your hair in place, not brushing it. There's a laugh from behind the curtain, nasty and sharp. The man again. But then gardening's in the family, isn't it? He says. I suppose ruining people's lawns is some sort of big joke for you lot. And don't think I've been kept in the dark about your sneaking in to see my mother before. I wonder what it's all about. But I only wonder for a second, because finally, Elizabeth is opening her eyes. She makes a croaky sound, and I know she's speaking, but I can't understand her. The words are too soft, too wet and runny. Her hands push a little way inside the opposite sleeves, but I can still see the flesh of her wrists. They look unnaturally soft, boneless and puffy, and the skin is smooth, as if she's been filled with air. Her lips are cracked, but she pulls them into a smile. She pulls one half into a smile and tries again to speak. I feel as though I'm failing to catch something precious. The words tumble out and hit the floor and are lost. None of us went to bed the night the madwoman died. Instead, we kept a kind of vigil, Ma and Douglas and I, and the insects that plastered themselves against the windows. What we were watching for, waiting for, I don't know. For some sense to come of it all, I suppose. When the light of dawn worked its way into the air outside, I went to stand in the garden and breathe it in. But my limbs were heavy and my eyes stung as I left the house. I walked blindly into the thick bramble hedge as I made my way up the path, and the hiss and sway of it made me jump in fright before I remembered that the mad woman would never again appear between the leaves of any hedge, would never shout or point or raise her dress to a bus, would never again chase me with her umbrella. And I regretted the relief I felt at the thought. Dad went off to work while I was in the garden, stopping to pick a couple of blackberries from the mass that hung along the wall. He did it furtively, as if he didn't want anyone to know he could still see the fruit or enjoy the taste of it. But I copied him as I watched him go, popping the berries into my mouth. It seemed the right thing to do. Fitting somehow, and anyway, it masked the stale morning taste on my tongue. I ate a few more, the sour ones making me search harder for the truly ripe and sweet, and then began to collect them in earnest, filling an old watering can which had been left in the grass. The berries broke from their buds with satisfying ease, and I wove my arms further into the brambles to reach the ripest. Douglas said nothing when he came to find me, but he too began to eat and collect, and carefully pull away the branches so that he could get deeper into the fruit's nest. I watched him for a moment, and there was a resemblance between him and the mad woman that was obvious when you knew about it. But I thought perhaps That was partly the situation. His arms buried in the foliage. And soon, my own mother was out with baskets and bowls and her own share of the harvest. We stripped the branches, greedy and quick, the berries collapsing between our fingers. As we picked, we filled our mouths, silently, intense and certain. I kept going until I could hardly lift my arms, and the skin of my fingers was flecked with tiny cuts from the blackberry thorns. It was then that Frank appeared. We heard his step on the path and turned together.
"Christ," he said, "you all turned cannibal."
I looked at Ma and Douglas and saw how their faces and hands were bloodied with the fruit as if they'd been devouring some animal alive. I could feel the juice clinging to my own mouth. We none of us laughed, but gazed at each other as if we'd just woken from a dream, our clothes stained, our skin pale, our eyes watering. Frank had brought sugar, and Ma wiped her hands and face on her apron to marvel at it, feeling the packages as if they were Christmas presents. "We could make jam," she said. "We've got the fruit for it."
"So I see," Frank said.
And he laughed. But still he eyed us, side on, uneasy. And he lit a cigarette with nervous hands, one cuff flapping at his wrist like a greedy seagull. Ma went inside, carrying our crop, and Douglas went on eating berries, but I'd lost my appetite for them. My skin itched where the juice had dried, and I felt irritated. I wished Frank wasn't there. I wished we could have gone on picking blackberries all day, not talking, just gathering, doing something that I didn't have to make sense of. I'd put off seeing Frank for days, walking the long way home when I saw him waiting at the end of our street, crossing the road when I was too near the Five Ways or any other pub I thought he might frequent. I didn't know what to say to him. I couldn't tell him that Douglas was waiting at the pavilion ballrooms every night in the hope that Suki would arrive.
"Looks like you've got smudged lipstick," Frank said, "like you've been kissing someone."
His hands had stopped shaking, and he put a thumb up to my mouth, letting it hover a fraction of an inch from my lips.
"I don't wear lipstick," I said,
the effort of not moving towards his touch making my words stiff. There was a scuffing sound as Douglas kicked at the wall behind me. Frank didn't look at him, but stroked his thumb lightly over the last of the wet blackberry juice on my top lip, and then smeared it onto his own.
"What do you think?" he said. "Perhaps I should start wearing it."
The absurdity of the action, the remark, made me giddy. "Now you look like you've been kissing someone," I said, as Ma called us in. "I was going to tell Frank," she said, when we got through the door, "about the accident." I saw Frank start at the word.
"What accident?"
"Douglas's mother. She was killed by a car." Ma was washing the fruit and turning it out into a pan to soften over the stove. And there was a moment of quiet before Frank spoke. When he did, his voice was watery.
"What a terrible thing," he said.
And unbelievably, he seemed close to tears.
"When was it? Were you there? God, it's terrible."
He let out a sob which made the rest of us jump, as if he'd smashed a plate.
"You might not think it's so terrible when you hear who she was," Douglas said.
His voice was angry, but his face, violently stained, was serened.
"Never mind about that," Ma said, wiping at the blackberry juice on his chin and silencing him. "I remember the first time I saw her," Frank said.
And there was a pause, during which, I think, we must all have been wondering what he would say next. But he didn't finish. He shook himself and went and stood close to Ma and helped her to force the heated, softened berries through muslin bags, dark pulp clinging to his fingers and slipping over his wrists. I boiled the fruit with the black market sugar and Ma cooled it and poured it into jars and sealed them with wax. The jam came out clear and rosy and delicious. And all the time, there was Frank, again and again on the verge of tears, because Douglas's mother had died in an accident.
"God, that bloody man," Helen says, hitting her hand on the steering wheel. "Blaming you for everything. Blaming me. As if how I make my living has anything to do with it."
"Well, it's Elizabeth I feel sorry for, with a son like that."
"Elizabeth is missing."
"Mum, we've just been to see her."
"She's missing.
And it's my fault."
"No, don't listen to that idiot. He shouldn't have left her alone in the garden when she was so unsteady on her feet. It's not your fault."
"It is my fault, because I looked in the wrong places. I collected rubbish from everywhere else, and all the time the real things were lying out there, waiting for me."
"What are you on about?"
"She was buried in the garden."
"Who was?"
"I can't think of the name. The one you're talking about."
"Elizabeth's in hospital, Mum. We've just been to see her."
"No, in the garden. Buried for years."
Helen shifts in her seat and slows the car.
"Whose garden? Ours?"
"At the new houses. She disappeared and they built those houses. And Frank brought tons of soil to lay over the gardens, and he planted things there. And the summer squash were nearly ruined after someone was in the garden. Digging."
"New houses? You mean at Elizabeth's?"
"Elizabeth is missing."
"No, Mum. We've just been to see her."
"She's buried. You've been through that."
"But it's not Elizabeth, is it?"
"Elizabeth is missing."
"It's the wrong name. I know it's the wrong name, but I can't think of the right one."
Helen stops the car.
"Who do you think is buried in Elizabeth's garden? Is it Suki?"
"Suki, that's the name. Suki. Suki."
My chest muscles relax slightly.
"Mom?"
Helen wrenches the handbrake up with an awful stuttering.
"It's my fault. I was there. I knew the place because of the pebble wall. And if I'd just gone to dig too, I'd have found it all out and Ma wouldn't have died without knowing. I thought it was nothing. Just the mad woman doing something to frighten me. But Suki's things were in the garden, waiting for me, marking the place. Her compact was there. I found it too late, far too late. Now I'll never find her, will I? She'll always be missing, and I'll always be looking for her. I can't bear it."
"Neither can I," Helen says under her breath. "Right, that's it. Get out of the car.
Wait.
I'll help you out."
She comes and opens my door, and I see we're the other side of the park, beyond the green and yellow house and the hotel and the acacia tree. And while I am stroking my fingers over the pattern of black and white pebbles on the wall, Helen is getting something from the boot of the car. The side gate is closed, but she wedges in the point of a shovel, and the wood frame explodes into splinters.
"Come into the garden, Mum," she says, standing by the tapestry of moss and toad flax and holding the gate open for me.
"Come on.
I'll dig the whole fucking thing up if that's what it takes."
The lawn is brown and scarred, and there's a lot of bare earth where there should be grass or flowers. Helen marches up and down carrying her tools. She bends to run her hand over the turf as if she's feeling for something under a rug. And then she stamps at various points, her left ear towards the ground. Finally, she throws down the shovel and lifts the fork high in the air, letting it fall sheer into the earth. The prongs sink deep and silent,
and she lifts them with a rolling tide of dirt and grass. I've bloody had it with missing people, and with sick people, and with dead people. I've had it with missing people's bloody sons, too, she says, as she stabs at the ground. So we'll dig to fucking Australia if we have to. I don't understand what she's doing. Is it for runner beans? I say, pointing at the wound she's making in the scabby lawn. Seems a funny place to plant them. She doesn't answer me, but talks to herself, swears. I peer into a greenhouse, empty and forlorn-looking. It's familiar somehow, and I move to stand inside for a minute, trying to place the smell of mildew, of rotten plastic plant pots and wood stain. A robin lands by the pile of earth next to Helen's trench. Fuck off! She shouts at it, waving her shovel. The bird flits away to perch on a branch of the apple tree. Helen, I say, where would be the best place to plant summer squash? For fuck's sake! She whips her head round as if she could make the words hit me. What's that got to do with... But whatever she says next is lost beneath the scrape of metal and stone as she starts digging in another place. Get a lot of sunlight here, she says. Good wall for wind protection. She's making an awful mess, and I wonder what it's all for. Perhaps this is how you landscape a garden, but that seems unlikely. So far, there are just great ugly holes in the ground. Unless they're for ponds, I don't see the point. A white plastic chair rests on a mound of sandy soil, and one of its legs sinks as I sit down. I find I am bent forward, studying the infinite amount of life on this little patch, peeping through holes in dock leaves and blowing on the bits of feather fallen from above. I brush my fingers over the bud of a dandelion, the thin petals pressed together like a nub of velvet. I can't resist pulling them out. It's too satisfying to feel the moment of resistance before they break away, each one a millisecond after the last. A snail moves through the undergrowth. I'll make you into jam, I tell it. I'll squint you up and push you through muslin and boil you with sugar. It pulls its horns in a moment, but doesn't stop. And then there's a cry. Nearly got a piece of metal in my eye, fuck, Helen says, climbing out of the hole she's dug. Her language is really terrible today. Bit of a shoe buckle, she says. Wait a sec. She kneels down and leans into the hole. There's something here, Mum. I get up creakily and go towards her, and she hands me a scrap of wood. Pale, except where the soil has made it filthy. The edges are crumbling with damp. Helen pulls more fragments from the earth, and the removal of the wood makes a cavity. Dusty soil begins to trickle downwards into it. There's something yellowish underneath. Something smoothly, frighteningly round, with rows of teeth, which bite into the soil as if they could carve a path to the surface. But what do you call it, this thing with no flesh and no hair, this face that stares without any eyes? Helen won't tell me when I ask, and as more dirt is displaced, I see it has a missing piece, a crack, a mark of violence, hollow and dark against the pallor. Mum, Helen says, go towards the house, will you? She reaches down again as I back away, and I see she's got more wood when she stands. More wood, and something circular. A little shallow pot. I know, even from this distance, that it's navy blue and silver, and I know it once held peach-coloured powder rather than blackish soil. Helen scatters the contents as she walks. Let's get in the car, she says, very low, her hands on my arms. Let's just sit in the car. The passenger door is opened and I'm pressed into the seat sideways. Helen kneels on the pavement at my feet and talks into her hand. There's something nestled in her palm, and she pushes it hard against her cheek as she speaks, glancing at the side gate every few seconds, as if she thinks something will escape. Side gate, I think. The side gate is open. It seems important, but I don't know why. Slowly, Helen lays out the bits of wood and the half a compact on the paving stones. I feel in my bag for the other half, lean down to reunite the two silver and blue circles, and squeeze my eyes shut against the image of Suki at our kitchen table, sweeping powder over her nose. My middle is pinched by the waistband of my trousers as I bend, and the blood seems to rush to my head. The bits of crumbling wood are like the pieces of a jigsaw, like the shards of a gramophone record. I try to put them together, but they are too wet and rotten like long-stewed meat. It doesn't matter. I already know they are part of a tea-chest, the kind that Frank always had lying round his house, the kind that he stored Suki's clothes in after she disappeared. Frank, I say, and my stomach churns. I feel as though I'm back with Audrey, drinking her father's gin. When she's finished speaking, Helen eases a flat oblong away from the skin of her face and lays out more things on the pavement. A handful of broken glass, the edges smooth like pebbles, a rusted shoe buckle, and the tiny skeletons of two birds, the bones twisted together with wire. Glass eyes are glued still to their skulls, and their beaks show traces of some kind of coloured enamel. And I know the last time I came face to face with these beaks was in Frank's house. They flew about her head, the madwoman said. The glass smashed, and the birds flew about her head. A bright checkered car stops by the house, and a man and a woman get out. They have white shirts with bulky black vests on top, and they've been labelled like my kettle plug and my tea jar. Their label is police. Helen jerks as if she's about to jump to greet them, but her legs shake, and she kicks the compact halves apart again. I push them together so that the hinges match up, and I brush more dirt away to make the silver stripes shine. I've been bent forward so long that my hands are a purplish red and I can feel my pulse in them. I am top-heavy with blood which throbs against my ears and seems to whisper, Suki, Suki, Suki. The policewoman goes through the open side gate and comes back out again. Right, she says. I can confirm that you have found human remains. Yes, Helen says. And you've taken these things here out of the scene of burial? The policewoman asks. Yes, Helen says. She's told off by the policewoman, who says we mustn't touch anything else. She lists all the things we aren't allowed to touch. All the things that are in a row at my feet. Bits of glass, a makeup container, some wood, bird skeletons. I push myself upright, away from the collection of things. But I have to touch them. I have to.
And this is not your garden?
The policeman asks.
No, Helen says.
It belongs to a friend of my mother. The policeman looks at me. His eyebrows go up. He takes a few steps back.
It's you, he says. I can't believe it. It is you, isn't it?
Yes, it's me, I say.
Don't you recognize me?
He hunches down so I can see his face better. There's a boyish grin on it that reminds me of someone. I'm the one you always report your friend Elizabeth missing to.
I don't react quickly enough, and a twitch of disappointment crosses his mouth.
Oh, yes, I say. Hello.
It's always me, he says, turning to the policewoman. I should have followed her lead. She's been sitting on a centuries-old murder here.
It's not centuries old, and we don't know it's a murder, the policewoman says.
She pulls at her black vest and faces Helen.
Why were you digging in this garden?
I was looking for the body, Helen says.
You knew it was here?
No. Not really.
The policeman is told to get something from the car, and he and the woman begin tying blue and white ribbon around a tree.
It flaps in the breeze like bunting, but there are no flags, only the words, "Do not cross."
While he's occupied, I move my foot so the edge of my shoe is against the tiny skeleton of a bird. The contact makes it possible to breathe again. Blood drains away from my heavy head, and still it seems to speak.
Is this what they mean by the blood singing in your veins? And is there a way to stop it?
You brought the tools with you, the policewoman says. She doesn't notice my foot.
I'm a gardener, Helen tells her. I have a gardening business. I usually have shovels, forks, trowels in the boot of my car.
The policewoman tells her she'll have to take the tools for investigation, and Helen says she understands.
Her hand lifts once from the pavement, and there are red ridges on her palm. I offer my hand, wanting to soothe the marks away, but she doesn't notice. Instead, she tries again to get up, and the policeman comes closer to help her.
The blood has stopped singing in my head, and now the voice is gone. I want it back.
I lean from the car to feel it throb again, to hear it whisper to me, and I press my fingers to the crumbling wood.
Please don't tamper with the evidence, the policewoman says, rolling up the leftover tape.
She looks at Helen.
Why didn't you call the police if you suspected there was a body here?
Helen lets her arm hang limp in the policeman's hold.
I didn't really suspect it. I'm afraid you'll have to come with us to the station, the policeman says.
He guides Helen away, and I let my hand swoop down. In an instant, I have a tiny piece of glass in my hand. I hold it hard, the edges smoothed by soil, and I can see the glass dome shining in the light of the fire, the eyes of the birds gleaming. I can see Suki sewing on the sofa, her hair curling up the fabric behind. It's so close and so far away, and I wish for a moment the glass was sharper, so that I could feel it properly.
Are you sure you don't want someone to sit in with you?
This man has reddish hair and freckles. So many freckles that it is hard to make out his features. Hard to tell when he smiles.
How are you doing? Would you like any water if you don't want tea? Are you comfortable?
No. I can't get comfortable in this seat. My waist feels as if it's being pummeled by the top of my trousers. I look to undo the button, but there isn't one. Only elastic.
I wish I could take these off, I say, and have one of those things like a cooking pot for humans. You know, for boiling humans.
He says he isn't sure what I mean, and I can't read his expression because of the freckles. His face is so marked, it's blank. Like the walls of this room. They are so blank that I don't have to see them at all. And if I look past the man sitting opposite me, I have space to picture every detail of Suki's sitting room.
Where's my sister? I say.
Don't you mean daughter? Another officer is interviewing her in another room. As I explained before, Your daughter is also a witness, so we have to interview you separately. We've decided not to caution you, but we are going to have to take a witness statement. Do you understand?
He's very neat, this man, despite the mess of freckles on his skin. He sits carefully, facing me, smiling, I think. I press a pebbly piece of glass into my palm. I'm not a witness, I say. If only I could take my things off and slide into a pool of water. Bath.
I'm sorry.
That's the word I was looking for.
Right. Good. Can you tell us anything about the body found in the garden of the property of Elizabeth Markham?
Elizabeth is missing, I say. But the words are like dust.
Yes, a colleague of mine said you've been in several times to report her missing. Was it Mrs. Markham you were looking for?
I stare at the bare walls, looking through them to Suki's sitting room. The house is full of things, I say. There's a shoe scraper by the sofa, and a chipped Chinese vase under the window. It's full of carved walking sticks, frilly umbrellas, and an old dress sword, and it tips over whenever there's a breeze. A little writing box has been balanced on a music stool, and two marble lions sit at the foot of a washstand. There's hardly room to move, and I have to be careful.
Mrs. Horsham, you understand what was found in the garden?
I try to picture it, but I can't. I don't have the energy to think of two places. I study every bubble in the grey paint of the wall, trying to be back in that room with Suki. If only I could get back there. If only I could be with her again. The smell of coffee interferes. She never drank coffee, and I glance in anger at the white plastic cup on the table.
Have you any idea how long the body might have been there? We have information, in fact, your daughter suggested, that it could have been there since 1946. Have you got anything to add to that?
1946 is when my sister went missing.
Susan Gerard, formerly Susan Palmer. Is that right?
Suki, I say. And I think of blood singing. But what has blood got to do with anything?
Suki, that's what you called her. And she went missing in the autumn of 1946, correct?
Yes. How long ago is that?
It's nearly 70 years.
I think for a moment of the cold earth around the pale bones, and I feel the same cold creep inside me. And if I had known, I would willingly have curled into that wooden chest and kept her company for 70 years. I would never have let her be alone all that time. I would have done anything to be near her, the way this bit of glass was. I press it between my fingers, feeling how it has warmed from my touch, as if some life had been forced into it.
"You've seen the body," the man says, "or perhaps I should say the skeleton. There is evidently damage to the skull. Can you tell me anything about that?"
"The glass smashed, and the birds flew around her head."
"Birds? It looks as though there's glass and the remains of birds in with the body. Is that what you're referring to?"
"It's what the madwoman said."
"The madwoman? Who do you mean by that?"
"She hated those birds, Suki did. All dyed wings and glass eyes. One day they'll fly out and peck her. That's what she thought. I was more afraid of the other things. The house was full of things to trip over. I thought she'd fall and break her head. I thought it was a death trap."
Which house is this you're talking about?
Frank's house.
Frank? Is that Frank Gerard? We have him down as a possible suspect. Can you tell us anything more about him?
He was a jealous man, was Frank.
Was he?
I don't know. Someone said he was.
Who said?
I can't remember.
Okay. We'll come back to that.
He takes a sip of the coffee and then one of water.
Do you have any knowledge of the whereabouts of Frank Gerard?
No.
Did you know he had a record? For disturbing the peace? Accepting stolen goods? Aggravated assault?
I didn't know. A tiny bit of glass magnifies the lines on my hand, and I think of Suki sewing, and not wanting to disturb her neat row of stitches, and of the fire warming me right through. If I could just get back to that room, everything would be right again. I won't look at the birds on the mantelpiece. I'll cover them with her shawl, and I'll help her to make a blind for the kitchen, and when Frank comes home...
When Frank comes home, what? What would happen?
Nothing, I say.
Okay, I'll ask you about that again later. Something else we have to do is to establish how the body came to be in the garden of Mrs. Markham's property. Did your sister have any connection to it?
No.
But you do believe the body we found to be that of your sister? What made you think she would be there? Did Frank Gerard have a connection to it, perhaps?
He helped someone to plant summer squash.
So he had access to the garden?
I don't know.
We know he ran a removals business from 1938 to 1946. Did he perhaps deliver furniture there?
I don't know.
Teeth show up white against the freckles. You liked Frank, didn't you?
He loved Suki.
The man takes another sip of coffee. I stare again at the wall and think of Suki joking with a soft-faced removal man, and of the madwoman eating the hawthorn by the lane. And then I think of Frank. In a moment, he will come into the room. And then, the man asks, what will happen then?
Then Suki will run out screaming because of the madwoman, and Frank will tell her to go to the station hotel. Only she never goes, because Frank does something. Pushes her into the mantelpiece, hits her so she falls, brains her with a glass dome full of birds. Something that cracks her skull and makes the stuffed birds tumble about her head. I'm careful to think and not to speak. And the freckled man carries on asking me questions, but I can't answer, because if I speak, I'll say too much. I'll say the madwoman saw it all. I'll say Frank put Suki into a tea chest and buried her in the garden of a house where he knew no one yet lived. I'll say he offered to help plant the summer squash so he could control where the ground would be dug and how deep. I'll say these things if I speak. But they can't be true. They can't possibly be true.
What will happen now? Do you know? Helen asks, taking her keys and unlocking the car. They'll verify your stories, the policeman says. Ascertain the age of the remains found. Try to trace any other witnesses as well as possible suspects.
They'll try to find Frank?
If that seems to be a reasonable line of inquiry.
The words sound like the correct ones, but he ruins the effect with a grin. I rest a hand on the car, curling my fingers against the window, and try to imagine a young girl running in zigzags to avoid snails.
but it's difficult to picture yourself in a memory. And all I can think of is Frank telling me how the new houses were nice, how he'd been here to move people in and had helped with their gardens. I stare at the glass, expecting shadows to flit across the surface like on a film screen. But the sky's reflection obscures whatever story might be shown, and everything is still until the policeman opens the door and helps me in. He puts a hand over my head in case I bang it, and leans across me to put my seatbelt on. When he moves back again, he winks.
"I suppose you've found what you were looking for," he says. "But I hope you still pop in from time to time, eh? Don't be a stranger."
He shuts the door, and I'm left wondering what he was on about. The car is stifling, though it's late in the day, and the sun's not strong. I can't get the windows to wind down, and I'm grateful when Helen opens her door and lets in a breeze.
"And the, body? I mean, if it is Suki?" she asks the policeman. "When might she be released?" "They'll have to establish that the body is who you say it is. There'll be a lot of tests to do to work out an accurate date of death, any injuries and cause of death, if possible. It might be 6 months, it might be longer. They'll let you know if and when."
She thanks him, gets in beside me, and turns the cold air on full blast. We drive a little way, the policeman waving us off as if he were an old friend, but stop once we're round a corner. Helen is breathing as though she's been pushing the car, not driving it. "You haven't taken up smoking, have you?" I was always afraid of that when they were kids. "Mum, I'm 56. Of course I haven't started smoking." "You do know what's happened, don't you?" I pat her hand again. I pat it very carefully, but I have a falling sensation inside, as if some important organ is coming loose. As if it's coming loose, and I have to be ready to catch it before it hits the floor. "Frank stopped me falling over the banisters in the station hotel," I say. "Did I ever tell you?" I remember thinking that if I'd been killed, he'd have got the blame, even though he'd never have meant me to come to any harm.
"Yes, Mum, you did tell me. But I always had the impression he'd been the reason you were so close to falling in the first place."
She starts the car again and drives very slowly, staying close to the side of the road. And she doesn't seem to notice when I read out the "ramp ahead" and "no footway" signs. Her hand shakes when she changes gear, and she isn't irritated when I ask where we're going.
"What happened to Douglas?" she asks.
"He went to America," I tell her, watching the dark gorse and darker sea trundle by outside the window. "It's where he always wanted to go, and that's why he liked to test out the phrases, the accent. I thought he might write, but he never did. Wanted to start afresh, I suppose. He sold everything he had for the ticket. Except the champagne aria."
"Ha ha ha," Helen says, stopping the car by the beach.
She helps me over the sand to the water. We both have soil under our fingernails, and we wash it off in the waves. A tiny piece of glass, like a pebble, is nestled in the crease of my palm, and I drop it through the surf to lie with the real pebbles amongst the sand. The sun is setting behind the pier, and we watch it sinking for a moment. I wonder what time it is, and what we've been doing all day. I wonder how we got soil on our hands and why Helen is shaking. She kisses me on the head, and my stomach growls. I check my cardigan pockets and my bag for chocolate, but there's nothing. My stomach growls at me again.
"And Frank?"
Helen stares out at the sea, It looks rough today. The waves misshapen boxes of colour. And I wouldn't like to swim in it.
What happened to him?
She twists her feet about so they sink a little way into a damp dune. He asked me to marry him.
What?
She turns quickly and one foot plunges further into the sand. Oh, a long time after. I was 22 by then. He'd been away. In prison, Dad said, but Ma and I could never be sure. Anyway, he turned up one day and asked me to marry him. Just like that. I said no, of course. I was already engaged to Patrick.
How did he take it?
I think about that for a moment, though it's painful to remember. I suspect he was relieved. But the sick, greyish look on his face when I said no looms up. And I wonder again whether I would have said yes if I hadn't already been engaged, and whether I resented Patrick for being in the way. And I wonder whether I would have minded a marriage where I had to remember my sister every day.
And, of course, it's likely he did kill her, Helen says, a bite in her voice. So that might have complicated things.
She stares at the blur between sky and sea.
But do you think he meant to?
I look back up the beach. I buried Suki there, I say. No, Mum, it was... And then she buried me. And I got cross. I always felt guilty afterwards for getting cross, and embarrassed for being so childish. She'd only been trying to entertain me. But the sand, closing around my body, heavy on my limbs, had made me frightened. And it was too easy to imagine the dunes rising over my head. After that, she was always careful to be the one who was buried. And I would heap handfuls of powdery grit on top of her, compacting it until she couldn't move, and smoothing it into shapes, giving her the tentacles of an octopus or the tail of a mermaid. And once I made her a dress of fingernails which I'd gathered from the shore. I'm sure that's right. I can picture them now, spread around her. Hundreds of pink fingernails pushed into the sand.
Epilogue.
I think he was hoping that one of them would turn out to be worth a fortune, but no such luck.
The voice is low, followed by stifled laughter, the direction of the speaker obscured by the mass of black-clothed bodies.
I can't help thinking she gathered all that junk just to make him wade through it. She might have known he wouldn't be able to resist taking the china for valuation.
Majolica wear, eh?
One last joke from Aunt Elizabeth. Poor Peter.
Thick dust swirls about in the heat and settles on shoulders and hips and thighs. The air is full of the smell of cheap new clothes. I'm trapped, suffocating. There seems to be no way out and nowhere to rest. I lean a shoulder on a sturdy-looking cloth-covered partition, but a fat woman makes a thin cry and moves away, turning to frown at me. I sag forward, my face grazing the lapel of a blazer, and for a moment I see a gap in the crowd. There is a creamy wall and a patch of light, and a board. A board with legs, piled with things to eat. I push towards it, while the people in their stifling black make downturned smiles and gulp at their drinks. God knows what they're doing packed together like this, like peaches in a tin. When I reach the creamy wall, I find that dust swirls here too, but it rises in the light, and the air is cooler. I pull up a sitting thing for sitting on. In a minute, I'll have to go back.
There's something I must do. I can't remember what it is just now, but I know it's important. Someone will tell me if I ask. The filled breads, the stuffed and buttered breads, are cut into squares, and my stomach growls. But I can't work out what I'm to do with them. I watch a man take one and bite into it, his fingers crushing, his lips sloppy. I feel queasy, but copy him all the same, cramming the thing into my own mouth. It slips against my tongue, cold and sharp and fetid at once. Someone comes at me smiling, and I move hastily out of the way, into the kitchen, where the oven's on, humming its own low, laughing comments, wearing its own hot black clothes. "Pass me that knife, dear, would you?" a red-faced, housewifely person says. I look around the room, but I can't think what it is she wants, and so I wander through a glass door onto a patio. Most of the space is taken up with those things, not boats. They're full of flowers, large pink flowers bobbing about in the breeze. But there is a bench at one end, and I can sit down. A tall woman brings me out a slice of fruitcake. She tells me it's fruitcake as she hands it to me, and I can see amber currants huddling under the crumbly surface. "How are you feeling?" she asks, sitting down. "Have I been ill? At least you got to say goodbye," she says. "Oh, have they gone already? I wasn't there to catch the bouquet." "Mum, it's a funeral. They don't throw bouquets at funerals." She smiles and then covers her mouth with her hand, looking back into the house. I stare past her at the bobbing flowers. The garden is very pretty, but it's not mine. "Where am I?" I ask. "Peter's house." I nod as if I recognize the name and pick the currants out of my cake, pinching them together. When a girl with blondish curls steps onto the patio, I throw the currants at her feet. She stops and blinks, doesn't skitter away, doesn't peck at the fruit. Perhaps because she has no beak. I think I know her. "Is that my daughter?" I say to the woman next to me, pointing at the girl. "Granddaughter," the woman says. The girl laughs. "You're too old to be my mother, Grandma." "Am I? You're 82. I wonder why she's lying. Does she think it's funny? "This girl's mad," I say. "She'll be telling me I'm 100 next." A man steps out and bends, swoops, to gather the currants, scattering them over the lawn. Two blackbirds flutter down to pierce them with their beaks, and the sight pierces me too. "Elizabeth is missing," I say, feeling a twist of something inside me, the memory of a smile. "Did I tell you?" I catch at the woman's sleeve before she's out of reach. I keep trying her house, but there's no answer. "I'm sorry," the woman says, standing to put a hand on the man's shoulder. "I have told her." "Poor Elizabeth," I say. "I haven't seen her since she came to our kitchen to collect currants from my mother's cake. Anything might have happened since. She needed the currants to feed the madwoman. The madwoman, who was really a bird and flew about my sister's head. My sister was frightened, and she and Douglas dug a tunnel to America. I tried to follow, but I couldn't dig that far. Perhaps they took Elizabeth with them." The woman doesn't think that's the answer, and the man begins to explain something to me. But I can't concentrate. I can see they won't listen, won't take me seriously.
So, I must do something.
I must?
Because Elizabeth is missing.
The Story Behind the Book by Emma Healy. One day in 2007, I was in the car with my father and my grandmother Nancy. She was showing the first signs of multi-infarct dementia, forgetting things that had just happened, and finding herself in a muddle. And she was worrying out loud about a friend. Flora was missing, she said. She had tried phoning her, but she had gotten no answer. It didn't take very long to discover the solution, as Nancy still had a lot of friends, and we soon got hold of someone who knew where Flora was, staying with her daughter in another town. So that was the end of the mystery. But the idea of it stuck in my mind. What if Nancy had been more isolated? Or if her dementia had been more severe and she hadn't been able to hold on to the answer? The episode brought her situation into sharper focus for me, and as her dementia worsened, I began to wonder what it was like for her. My father thought it might be like being permanently drunk. I thought this was a bit optimistic, but had no theory of my own. Occasionally, there seemed to be some logic buried in the things she said, but where the connections were in her mind, I couldn't be sure. I began to write a story from the point of view of someone in a similar position, to explore the possibilities. Then, in 2008, my other grandmother, Vera, was taken to the hospital. My mother called and asked me to get on the train, as Vera didn't have long left. I'd always been very close to Vera, spending most of my school days with her, and I was devastated. I couldn't concentrate on reading on the train, and my phone was broken, so I couldn't call anyone either. I spent the 2-hour journey writing down every story she'd told me about her life, especially about her childhood. I wrote down the stories, partly to feel close to her while I made the journey, and partly because I knew this might be my last chance to capture them before they were lost. Over the next few days at the hospital, I went through the stories with her. She liked to reminisce, not only to check the facts and add the details I'd forgotten, but also to prove to her that I'd been listening all these years, that her stories hadn't gone unnoticed. Some of those stories made it, in one form or another, into this book. Vera really was chased by a mad woman with an umbrella. Her parents took in lodgers. She had a velvet bolero and a blue suit. She used to eat young hawthorn leaves when she was a child, which she called bread and cheese. And when she met my grandfather, she knew instantly that he was the man she was going to marry. It was a few months after she died that I began to write Elizabeth is Missing in earnest, combining the exploration of dementia, prompted by Nancy, with some of the stories I'd collected from Vera. This is Davina Porter. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Elizabeth is Missing by Emma Healy. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Karen Jagonski. Text copyright, 2014 by Emma Healy. Production copyright, 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.